Ugh, my MacBook needs to be charged. Okay, wait. I need to stretch my charger across my room to charge my MacBook real quick. I'll be right back. Oscar is definitely going to leave this in for jokes now. All right. Hello, listeners, and welcome to Fighting Failure, the podcast where we discuss solutions to the climate crisis. I'm Hisham, as many of you know, and I'll be your host for this episode. Oscar was unavailable to record today, but he is eternally with us in spirit. And in editorial power.
Mwahaha.
I can almost hear him speaking to me through the editorial power.
Just start already.
But today we have a very special guest. Taryn, please introduce yourself.
Yeah. Hi. It's nice to fill in again.
He did a spectacular job filling in for me on the Palm Oil episode hosted by Sandhya. We miss you, Sandhya. And go back and listen to that episode if you haven't already. That was a great episode. Anyway, today is going to be all about the pollutants. And the pollutants that I'm referring to are generally anthropogenic problems, which means that they're all human-caused. And we've already looked into some of these pollutants in prior episodes, and you definitely know them from around. So why don't we start on the problems? So, Taryn, would you like to intro us?
Yeah, sure. So, air pollution is one of the most obvious forms of pollution, especially in connection with climate change, and it's most dense in urban areas. Often buildings trap air pollution, and this means that it sort of sticks around in cities, and when it gets really bad it can be known as smog and is invisible and sort of descends on cities, and that's a combination of smoke and fog, and it obstructs light, doesn't look very nice, and it's very nasty stuff.
Yeah. And so the most basic problem that we really need to delve into here, which I hope most of you already know, is the greenhouse effect, which is, of course, you get cars, in cities, you get people, the electric grid might not be green, you have factories around the cities, perhaps. Anyway, you have these large amounts of emissions from different sectors within the city, and this CO2, or we'll refer to it as CO2. There's different types of pollutants, air pollutants, but CO2 is generally how it's measured. And CO2, it's released into the atmosphere, and what it does is it essentially traps the heat. So, I'll leave it at that and not get too much into the science, but it essentially traps the heat. And what happens is that, you know, the way that in a greenhouse, it's all these glass slats, that it's, you know, greenhouses are used to, create, ideal climates to grow plants. And that's because they trap heat so well and trap moisture so well. And that's essentially what's happening with our planet as we release more and more of these pollutants, is that we're trapping heat, and then that's causing innumerable problems. We've passed the point of no return in terms of like the northern glaciers. They're definitely as far as science can tell, science has been wrong before, so don't dread, but as far as science can tell, we're past the point of no return, which means that essentially the northern glaciers are all going to melt and collapse into the ocean, and this will cause sea levels to rise as those glaciers melt, and this will encroach on urban areas, and on seaside cities, and this causes, you know, of course, innumerable problems. It'll cause refugees. There's already refugees from small island nations, and there's, you know, increased tsunamis has been a big problem. Ocean acidity levels are increasing, and we have all these arrays of problems that kind of branch out from the greenhouse effect. Taryn, do you have anything to add?
I'd say you covered that pretty well. I mean, obviously there are infinite problems nearly that stand out from that, and we could spend a whole episode of many episodes going on and on about that. But I'd say that's a fair summary.
Would you like to hit the next point?
So the next problem, which is maybe a bit more short term, seems closer to home to city dwellers, is air pollution within cities and the poor quality of air that creates. So as opposed to, although that does make that is related to the greenhouse effect in that it can be released into the upper atmosphere and contribute to that. It is particularly bad for health of urban residents and can be related to cancer, respiratory issues, pneumonia, and various other things depending on the type of pollutant. This is obviously not ideal and makes living in a city much less attractive.
And this is a problem not only in kind of these big, very well publicized as sort of not very eco-friendly cities such as Delhi in India, but this is a problem in like every city. I mean, even you know, all these big cities, and it's not, maybe it's not as evident in some cities, but there's always this aspect, you know, you get a city, it's a big, you know, hub, and there's always going to be this pollution, this particulate pollution, according to the way that we're living. Not always, like, you know, if we somehow went like eco-hippie and ditched our cars and everything, but even then we still have that buildup in those areas. And so there's this problem of like, you get a ton of people crammed into one area, and then you get a ton of emissions in that area, and then that causes problems for the people. And further, this causes problems for the animals. I mean, this causes problems for bird life, and can be very detrimental to ecosystems by directly harming them, and, you know, often leading to the death of birds. And the next point is sort of the release of sulfur dioxide, which generally comes from electric utilities and charcoal burning, and then nitrogen oxide, which is generally put out by automobiles. And these are, you know, also sources of air pollution, but can further lead to acid rain, which I think is a term that's used quite commonly without a lot of people really knowing what it is. And acid rain is not like it rains very concentrated acid that will melt your skin off or anything. It's not a sci-fi movie. But what this can essentially do is it can raise acidity levels in the soil and surrounding bodies of water. And this can lead to the destruction of microbiomes and be very, very detrimental to surrounding plant life. As, of course, if you've listened to episodes from the agriculture section last season, you probably know that as you kind of degrade these microbiomes within the soil, it makes it much harder for plants to grow. And this is a big problem with acid rain, especially in the northern hemisphere. In Scandinavian countries and in sort of the eastern U.S., acid rain is increasingly common. And it's also, I should point it out, that acid rain is not always coming. It's not always that people are putting off emissions and the rain is coming right there. It's our weather patterns greatly affect where that falls. So you might be putting out sort of sulfur dioxide fumes somewhere, and then those kind of get, as a result of our weather patterns, get accumulated in another area. And then that sort of is where it rains down and causes this acid rain and problems. So just good to point that out. And then...
Well, yeah, climate change doesn't respect borders, so it won't... It's not like it's your personal legacy load of emissions, because, I mean, that's one of the big problems with facing climate change, is that everyone thinks about themselves as their own actions affecting their lives, whereas that's not the case, because obviously, you know, as you mentioned before, people in small island developing states will be more likely to be affected by these things, or the weather patterns might dictate who gets affected by what, which is really hard to think about because it requires people to be selfless, which is tricky sometimes.
Not always a natural part of the human nature, not always something that, I mean, there's this whole debate, it's, you know, I think increasingly over the last couple of years, since sort of the problems of, you know, the climate crisis was sort of started to get recognized, and all these other problems, we started to recognize wars as being great problems, and there were all these large historical events, and people started discussing whether or not, you know, selflessness and selfishness were built into the human character or not. And that's a kind of a great philosophical debate. But anyway, moving on from that, this acid rain, yeah, that would be a long tangent. We could go on that for ages. Yeah. But this this kind of acid rain, which we were talking about, can then cause the collapse of entire ecosystems. And an example of this is, you know, if surrounding bird life is indirectly affected. So as a result of having a reduced food source, because say it's like a seabird, it's reliant on fish from the surrounding bodies of water, and those fish, the fish numbers have been declining in that body of water. Those birds lose their source of food there, and they're either forced to adapt and migrate to somewhere else where it's fish is more reliable, or they just get driven into the dirt and kind of their numbers decline as well. And it causes this entire collapse of the ecosystem as you get these problems. And I think it's also something to notice that, you know, it's not, you know, climate crisis is not only something that you see. It's not like it's not always direct. It's not always like, you know, plastic stuck on a penguin's neck, something that we've directly done. It's something that happens to one animal, that happens to another animal, that has an effect on another animal, that has an effect on another animal, and then this comes back to affect us. And so these kind of actions can have very indirect consequences that we might not be taking into account. So I think it's very important to be conscious of this.
Yeah. Also, I just wanted to add something about the acid rain. Is I think another effect of climate change, which I think you might have mentioned before with flooding, is increased rainfall. And this can be especially a problem in cities because clouds, which rain comes from, obviously, have to form around tiny little particles called condensation nuclei, and this is released in air pollution, and despite being very, as well as being very damaging to our lungs and etc., it can also increase rain and change weather patterns as well, which is concerning in some circumstances.
Yeah, so moving on from that, let's look at sort of plastic pollution now. So this is probably the most well-known and guilty types of pollution as a result of how very immediate and visible the threats are. And this is sort of, I mean, looking at what I was just saying a couple seconds ago, I mean, problem number one is the direct detrimental effects that this has on the ecosystem. So like these images which immediately pop into our minds are like pelicans scooping plastic out of water, thinking it's a fish and soon dying after, whales eating plastic out of the ocean and dying, penguins getting plastic stuck around their necks and dying, crows and other bird life around town pecking at some and ultimately eating some plastic and dying. And we've all heard these stories and seen these pictures, and it's truly devastating and heartbreaking to think that we could have such a, you know, to think that we could cause so much pain to so many animals through our actions, and to think that these actions, we're not consciously trying to, I mean, at least most people aren't trying to, you know, do any of this with malice at the forefront of their reasoning, but I think it's just that it's something that we've sort of dismissed, and that our dismissal has led to all this pain, and it is devastating. And so this is problem number one, and I think this is why these sort of problems are generally the sort of go-to. You know, these are what people focus a lot of their time on, is because they can see the direct effect. But you know, again, we've mentioned that you get these indirect effects, and the most basic, common and stripped down scenario is plastic is thrown maybe onto a road near a river and is blown into the river, carried down the river, and eventually feeds into the ocean, breaks down into microplastics, is mistaken for food by small fish and krill, which are eaten by larger fish, which are eaten by dolphins and are then poisoned by accumulation of microplastics in their systems, as they're like super toxic, or end up poisoning their young via their breast milk, which is also contaminated. And this is the sort of thing which we might not see, but we kind of need to understand, and we need to bring to people's attention. Taryn, you have anything to add?
Yeah, well, that's one of the, I mean, it's the thing about plastic, is it's this wonderful material that doesn't break down, and that's obviously got its benefits, because it means it's a great, durable and cheap material. But it means when we dispose of it, It doesn't break down either. So this legacy load of plastic that we've put into our oceans will stay with us for a long time because it's a very durable material in all its forms. And it will go into smaller and smaller parts, but eventually it'll still damage every layer of the ecosystem because it won't be broken down in one animal's stomach. It will then be eaten by another and go into the next and climb up the food chain, as you were saying, causing sort of a horrible chain reaction of nastiness.
And I mean, in a sense, this is our own wit is coming back to bite us in the butt because we've created this, I mean, through our intellectual capabilities, we've kind of created this magical solution. But, you know, I think we're going to be the downfall of ourselves. We're definitely going to be we're our greatest weakness. And I mean, this is the problem, is that we find something good and we immediately, or that we think of as good, and we immediately jump to the conclusion that it's the solution, without considering kind of these knock-on effects. And it's causing so many problems and so much pain worldwide. It's hard to see. And this affects humans as well. I mean, I forgot to write this down in the show notes, but, this kind of indirect, you know, plastic pollution where you get like maybe a fish eating krill with, or a fish eating smaller fish with microplastics. And then we go fish, you know, we have these fisheries, we buy a salmon, and then that salmon might be slightly contaminated with microplastics. And then we're eating that. And so I think, I saw an article just the other day that the first ever traces of plastic were found in someone's blood the other day, which was undocumented as of now. But I mean, now plastic is so much a part of our lives that it's a part of us, literally, through what we consume and where we are.
Yeah, well, I also, a couple of years ago, I was watching a documentary. I think it was a BBC documentary. I can't remember. I think it was War on Plastic, BBC documentary. And they went to the Antarctic and they tested walrus droppings for plastic. And they found that most of the walruses there had microplastics contained in their excrement. So... yeah, so that was, I found that quite striking because I always thought of Antarctica as the most remote, sort of untouched, unspoilt place on Earth by humans. But it turns out that plastic's got there too, so it really is inescapable now.
That's a great point. And I mean, the effect that we're having is, it's really a problem with carelessness. I mean, it's not... there's definitely some ways that we can reduce our plastic consumption, that we can reuse our plastics. And in a lot of cases, we can even cut our plastic usage. Sorry, yeah. And I mean, the problem really just comes down to carelessness. I mean, people not giving a second thought to consuming something packaged in plastic, people laminating everything. I mean, I can point out over 100, maybe... over 1,000 plastic items in my room. Like, there's plastic is just everywhere, and it's just not thought of. I mean, it's woven into our clothes, almost, you know, all these sporting clothes that we have today have some sort of synthetic some plastics in them. And that's, I mean, it goes to show how little we think about our consumption of plastics. And then when we have people throwing away plastic, I mean, sometimes it's because of a lack of education, but I think oftentimes it's just because people go, well, it's too late to do anything. And I mean, it might be too late in some areas, but it's definitely not too late in terms of the plastic crisis. I mean, we still have the potential to resolve that. I mean, we're on a threshold, and right now we have the decision to either to continue putting out plastic or to cut down on our plastic consumption, make a conscious effort to try and sort of clean the planet.
Yeah, well, I think a big problem that we face is we've got this, there's, I don't know if it's biological or just this inherent primitive instinct that we grab what we can get because I suppose as far as natural selection's concerned, it's you know, survival of the fittest. Get as much as you can, and don't look back in remorse. And these sort of Victorian values, I think play quite a heavy part in why we've done all these things without thought, because nobody ever, you know, it never even came into anyone's mind that this might be destroying other species, because we've always been under the assumption that the world is sort of an infinite place, but the reality is we've grown so much as a species that we need to start thinking about looking after our home, because it isn't limitless. And I suppose this might relate back actually to can't remember what episode it was, the coexistent mindset one, where we've got to change the way that we think about waste and the way that we think about the resources we use, because if we just give up that easily and you know, think, it's done, we can't be bothered to put in the effort to try and save our home and save ourselves in the long run, then that's going to end in catastrophe, and it's not fair on future generations.
And neither is it fair on the animals that we share the planet with. I mean, I think it's such a part of human nature to think about ourselves and to think about our children. But I mean, I know some people do care about, other animal life on the planet. And I hope that most listeners do, and I hope that most people do, and can find it in themselves to care. And it's not only about saving us, but it is about saving. It's about saving everything. It's about saving our world, our planet, and the animals that we share it with.
Yeah, I suppose it goes hand in hand in a way, because ultimately we can, for the most part, we can do so much damage. But eventually, if we, you know, it will just come back to bite us, and then we'll be gone, and then millions of years later, the Earth will recover. I mean, there have been mass extinctions before, but the amount of suffering that would create, you know, the amount of suffering that would create would be so massive that I just can't imagine that. And you know, we'd be gone. So much for us.
I mean, yeah, we're facing an extinction on a level that we've never seen before. I mean, it's bigger than any extinction that the planet has ever faced. And the planet, it has its way of rebounding. And the planet might survive, but it won't be our planet anymore. And I believe that a lot of the animals that we share it with currently, you know, also will make it through this crisis if we continue going at the rate we're going. And then whose planet is it? I mean, the cockroaches, and I mean, what's left? I mean, eventually life will recreate itself. I mean, eventually life will recreate itself in some form, but I mean, it's just, yeah, it's such a shame to see so much go. And it's something that's avoidable. It's not like, it's not inevitable. It's not something that we can't avoid. It's something that we have 100% say in. It's just something that we've begun to accept, and that's, you know, one of the biggest problems here.
Absolutely. Right, well, we've digressed a bit, I think, but, you know, all valuable digression. So, do you want me to go with the next? Okay. So, the next problem to discuss is oil pollution, which is another thing that's quite a sort of heart-wrenching subject. You might have seen, I'm sure many viewers have seen images on the news of sort of, you know, big oil spills and, you know, penguins dying of pollution in that regard. Anyway, 14 of the world's 17 largest cities on the planet are located on the coast. This is because it's a very is a very efficient place to be, especially when ships were when before airplanes, when ships were the biggest form of international trade. And because of this, the oil refining industry was because it's generally centered in cities near the big factories, was also put near the coasts and in cities near the coasts. This all sounds great, but as a consequence of that means there's a lot of oil surrounding the coast and in those sort of areas, and if there's a system failure, as has been seen in quite a few occasions across human history, then there can be massive oil spills into the sea. And not only is that inefficient, and it's also extremely damaging to the city population, to the wildlife surrounding it, and to the long-term ecosystem, because the oil will disperse and it will stay around for a long time. Of course, these spills can happen in lakes and stuff and other bodies of water, but generally oceanic oil spills are the most detrimental. And that could be from a capsized oil tanker ship, or a oil rig breaks, or any one of those things. And because the massive amounts of oil that is taken around surrounding these areas, such high quantities and such high pressure, it will be released in minutes, and then you get thousands of tons of oil pouring into the sea, which is not great, as I mentioned before.
And this can even be small boat leaks. Not only these large scale catastrophes, but this can be small boat leaks that kind of over time in areas with a lot of boating accumulate and then cause problems on a large scale. I do have something else to sort of add to that, huge thanks to my bio teacher. Shout out to you, Miss, for pointing this out to me today. But there's this lack of media coverage on a lot of these oil spills. A lot of these oil companies do go sort of under the radar, either with bribes, trying to cover it up. But there's there's always some loophole, and these oil companies often take advantage of that, and they sort of evade the public eye by taking advantage of these. And this is quite a large problem, because I think a lot of people don't realize the sheer number of oil spills that occur on a yearly basis, and the magnitude of these oil spills. It's crazy the number of oil spills that we have every year from different sources in different places, and on different scales. And the fact that this stuff is not being communicated to the public is horrendous. It's terrible. And so it's just important for the public to be able to understand and to recognize. And I think it's something which I'm constantly pointing out, is just this idea of being conscious. Because if you're not conscious of what's going on, and you're not trying to be conscious, because oftentimes a lot of these articles won't make headlines, then you miss out on a lot of this, and you end up, benefiting these exploiting companies and such. And so it's just something I wanted to add. Taryn, would you like to?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Personally, it's never been a matter that I've really looked into much. But this is a very basic Google search, and it's probably not quite reliable. But according to this source, there are around two large oil spills every year from from tankers, but of course there are many more smaller ones, as you said, that aren't covered by the news and that aren't shown. Exactly. So I don't know, it would be interesting to know, I'm sure this would require a lot more research, how much oil is actually spilled into the ocean every year, because I'm sure it would be a vast amount, which is not only really inefficient for you know, oil companies, but it's also really detrimental. Yeah. And the fact that these sort of these oil companies can just get away with it just because they have a lot of money, and you know, I mean, I don't know about the UK. In the UK, this isn't the case, but a lot of I know a lot of developing nations have just one sole oil and gas company which supplies all of their oil. So this means like governments and stuff don't have really any power over these oil companies, and they can't really do anything. They can't. They sort of, their hands are tied, which means that they have to. They choose not to to punish them, which I suppose is fair enough for the governments. They don't really have much choice, but I don't know. It just seems a bit wrong.
Yeah, I agree. And then I mean, just to. Yeah, again, point out these kind of obvious, kind of direct, consequences that these oil spills have been having. Sorry, when I start getting emotional, I start to stutter. That these oil spills have been having, you know, globally, you know, just looking at like seabirds and marine life. I mean, I see definitely like almost on a weekly basis, I see pictures of seabirds, whales, dolphins, penguins. I mean, they're seabirds, but they're a little bit, I mean, they're so far south. It's just, it's a little bit shocking when you also realize that, like Taryn said earlier, that, you know, that our effect, that our sort of climate crisis has reached them in that kind of remote location. You see these animals just drenched in oil, and it's very heartbreaking. Again, I mean, a lot of these kind of direct effects that we have are very obvious and are very heartbreaking to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would agree. I mean, whenever I see a picture of a dolphin swimming in oil murky water, it is horrible, and that will in turn feed back to us, because you know, if there are oil spills in our, especially around coastal areas, because that's where most oil spills happen, is that's where we do most of our fishing as well, so that will have a direct impact,
yeah,
on
and
us.
And then again, you have, so yeah, that indirect kind of consequence that comes back to sort of nip us. I mean, there's always that factor that we failed to take into account earlier, and then that will be causing us pain for many years to come. But anyway, I think let's move on to noise and light pollution. And first off, I just want to say that yes, it is a thing. Noise pollution and light pollution. Although a lot of people are sort of in disbelief that either of these things could be a source of pollution, are real. And noise pollution is kind of where there's this abundance of anthropogenic, which is human-caused noise, generally coming from highly populated areas such as cities, which is why it's sort of in this section. And then this interrupts like these naturally occurring sounds in the area. And I'll explain why that's pollution in a second. But first, let's look at light pollution, which is very similarly when there's an abundance of unnatural light that disrupts the natural light patterns in the area. And noise pollution can come from, first off, come from mining, explosives, traffic, construction, catering, so like events, and then also animals, like domesticated animals like dogs. And so then this can be a problem for animals that are reliant on sound as a method of communication. And so a quick example, so we don't go on like a huge tangent here, is dolphins and whales. Which are, you know, they're heavily reliant on sound as a method of communication, as their primary method of communication, which means that when there's these underwater disturbances from unnatural blasts, and explosions, these animals can be not only put at harm, of course, but disrupted and confused, and have their kind of capability to communicate restricted, kind of limited, which is a huge problem, because then they lose that sort of, I mean, at least for that time being, they lose that communication. I suppose that some of these animals might cause long-term damage, and they might sort of essentially go deaf, which then entirely limits their capability to communicate. But before we go on too long on this, let's move on to light pollution. So,
I'm a member of Greenpeace, and I remember I got an email a few months ago about a shell project off the coast of South Africa. I just thought it was a great example because they were trying to, I don't know, extract oil or something from the coastland, and which has problems in itself, but for sound pollution, there's a population of I think it's whales, just whales, dolphins and turtles generally around that area that obviously use sound to communicate, as you were saying, and it was going to be blasting extremely loudly for 2 months, and I think the petition stopped it in the end, which is good, but it's just an example of one case, and I'm sure if any of the listeners want to look at that, they can find it on the Greenpeace website. But yeah,
I believe I added my name to that petition. I try and add my name to as many petitions as possible. I mean, I'm a supporter of Greenpeace, but yeah, I mean, I'm going to Cape Town soon for Easter break. And I mean, yeah, whale populations are crazy. I mean, I think it's around, I don't want to get this wrong, but around October, November, or maybe a little bit earlier in the year than that, you get these huge whale migrations, you know, as they're sort of feeding into their breeding areas. And it's just, I mean, I've heard stories from people, and I think I've seen it in some documentaries as well. I mean, you can just look out. You can be sitting down just, you know, on the coast, and you just look out, and there's just whales passing through. And then also, you know, I've seen crazy documentaries, of course, you know, from South Africa about, well, not from South Africa, but on South Africa, South Africa's marine ecosystems. And I mean, they have a variety of, like, dolphin, seals, sharks. And I mean, seals and sharks are a little bit less reliant on sound to communicate, but you have all these animals, and I mean, just to think of like the plethora of effects that kind of creating that oil rig in that location would have caused is it's scary. But I'm glad that that was put off, and I'm glad that I added my name to the petition and helped. I definitely recommend that you guys sign up for Greenpeace. It's a great way of signing petitions that actually help, that actually go somewhere. And I mean, I get emails daily, updating me, giving me new petitions to sign. So it's great for anyone who wants to make a change in any way possible. Sorry. So now let's light pollution. So it's quite similar. And as you may have guessed, lights, generally coming from, building street lights, car lights, etc. And an example of this being a problem for animals is during the hatching of baby sea turtles. These sea turtles are very reliant on the glimmer of moonlight off the reflective surface of the water to find their way to the ocean successfully. And so when there's this new light source being added to the nearby area, such as like street lights, they may see the street lights as a brighter source of light and then funnel to the street lights where they're like very likely to become roadkill, incidentally, or fall into gutters. And so this then drastically has been reducing the number of sea turtles in some areas. I saw this actually filmed in a, it was like was it Planet Earth or Blue Planet or something? Or maybe it was a newer documentary. I have a ton of BBC Earth. I love BBC Earth. Anyway, and there was one of these documentaries where I saw this as well. So I've read about this, but I mean, you can definitely find videos of it online, and it's just, I was almost in tears. I mean, it's tragic to see these, they're so cute as well, these baby sea turtles, and to see like more than half of them being drawn to these lights. And I'd never realized the magnitude of the problem with light pollution until that moment. And it just really struck me.
Yeah, well, another example, maybe less heart-wrenching, just because of the nature of the animal, but is moths, because they, everyone knows that don't leave your light on with the window open at night, because the moths will come in and flood around it. But that's actually because they have an instinct to follow the moon at night. Because that's generally, I don't know, I won't pretend to know all the details, but that's generally the way that they migrate and get to their breeding grounds and all that. But because of all this light pollution, that has been completely overturned. I mean, that's been a problem for many years, not just 21st century, but...
I mean, that's a huge problem, and just one more... I don't want to, you know, go on too much of a tangent here, but one more quite common problem with light pollution that, I mean, this might be one of the slightly better known ones, might not be as heart-wrenching, but definitely sad to hear about, because of just the spectacle, is fireflies. And during fireflies' mating seasons, they're reliant on their little flashing lights to essentially communicate to their mates, and decide mates so that they can breed and then, you know, produce the future generations, of course. And so when you have these unnatural light sources, you know, coming from houses often, this is like a very direct implication. This is not like the street lights that you didn't necessarily decide to put up. This is like you leaving on your lights causes a distraction and makes their lights a little bit more insignificant, and then it's harder for them to communicate, which then, you know, in turn leads to less mating per season, and then you have this drastic reduction of firefly numbers, which is, although it's not as, I mean, just maybe to some people it is heart-wrenching, but they're not like cute or anything, but it is very sad. I've definitely been in the city before, and I've been on like some small patches of green grass, like gardens, parks at night, and you see 1, 2, 3 fireflies, and you're like, how beautiful. But then you think, you know, you think to like these pictures that you see from some of the remaining truly wilded, like old growth forests, where what would have used to been kind of that, what would have used to be been that area, I don't know, my English has gone out the window, that area, which is, you know, sort of the city. And the spectacle, just the absolute awe which that leaves you in, and to think that, you know, now you only have 3, 4, or 5 fireflies that are actually lighting up that you can see, it's quite sad. I mean, it's not a happy thought, right?
No, I mean, fireflies is sort of something you hear about ever. I mean, I don't know. I don't know about in Malawi, but in the UK there used to be quite a few fireflies, but now. Now I've never seen a firefly before personally, and but I've always heard, I've always assumed that they're there, but I've never seen them before. And it is tragic that some of these species, however great or small they may be, are being driven out because of our monopoly on light, I suppose.
And I think this sort of perfectly feeds into our next point, which is on pesticides and fertilizers, and because everyone wants this sort of idyllic lawn, that could even be considered part of the American dream in many cases. I mean, it's something that I feel like it's a general standard that a lot of people have, is, you know, to have a nice lawn. A lot of people, especially in the USA, and I mean, I can feel Oscar just saying to me, you know, of course the USA, it's quite common. Yeah, exactly. It's very common for in city gardens to opt for pesticides to prevent their grass from being eaten by what they consider pests. And one of the problems here, which I'll just jump to quickly before I hand over to Taryn, is you get this kind of overlooking of fireflies. I think a lot of people think that, you know, they put these pesticides on their lawn, they pay for it to be done, and that it'll just kill the little aphids and the things that people consider just to be these little nasty pests that will eat away at their lawn. But what ends up happening is that you have fireflies as well, and you have even the cicadas as well. All these animals that are like burrowing underground, it's so hugely detrimental. And I don't think people think about that. I think people are generally thinking about the smaller things, but it's just another problem with people not being conscious, is people overlooking the bigger picture of what they're doing, and not kind of understanding the effect of their actions.
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes back to that sort of that mindset problem we were talking about before. But anyway, so we've obviously done a whole episode on pesticides, so we don't want to spend too long on it. But the general idea is that pesticides are obviously toxins, and they kill, as well as killing whatever you're trying to kill, pests on your lawn or whatever it is, it also kills important microbes in the soil, and basically creates sort of a defertilizer. I don't know if that's a word, but it makes the soil barren, and
it degrades, and it degrades the soil quality. And it turns, you know, this soil, which is something we generally consider rich, into dirt. And dirt is sort of, you know, as we've said in some previous episodes, dirt is dusty and crusty. And that's how I generally think of it, is that, you know, dirt's this kind of very infertile, dusty stuff or crusty stuff. And then you have soil, which is that you see like the nutrient-rich black soil that's coming from compost that might be in gardens or in forests. Like if you dig, you know, below the undergrowth. Anyway, Taryn, go ahead.
Also, fertilizers, although this seems a bit counterintuitive, have a similar effect, because although they're not designed to be toxins, if you put fertilizers, especially in large amounts, on soil, then it will also kill microbes and create a hostile environment in which you're only promoting one. Generally a monoculture, so if it's grass or in a farm, wheat. And that means that, again, you lose soil biodiversity, and you'll need more and more fertilizers as the plants become more and more, the plants are growing, and the soil quality decreases, and they become more reliant on those fertilizers that you're providing, which is a bad thing.
And Oscar loves the comparison of you know, fertilizers to a sort of drug, which they, you know, they, I mean, it's definitely an analogy that makes sense. I mean, essentially, I mean, as you put more and more fertilizer, you're just making the area more and more reliant, as Taryn said, because you're degrading the quality more and more, so you need more and more to keep the soil fertile. And so then, you know, it's like you do one hit, and then it's like, well, I mean, not that we've ever done drugs, just to put it out there, but I mean, like, you know, you hear about like drug addiction, it's like you do a hit, and then it's like, you know, next day to get that same high, you might need two hits or three hits or four, and then it just goes up and up, and then it gets to the point where it's just like you're getting such a good euphoric sensation from the use of these drugs that you end up just putting so much that you can end up overdosing and just kind of destroying that soil microbiome, and killing all the insects in the area and all the plant life in the area, and then essentially desertifying an area, an entire area. And I mean, it might also not be something that people think about as much if it's just a small patch of grass in their lawn. They're like, yeah, you can't turn into a desert. I mean, it's a small patch of grass, but it can get pretty close. I mean, it can it can degrade very fast, you know. When I say fast, I mean over like 10 or so years. I mean, you can degrade the soil greatly, and you become so reliant, and then you end up needing to spend more and more money, and then it becomes sort of a money pit to maintain your lawn, and of course, you know, not good for the for the ecosystem. And you know, pesticides and insecticides are targeting insect life. And so then you're, you know, you not only are you degrading the soil, but you're removing entire pieces of the food web. You're wiping them out. You're just kind of collapsing the ecosystem, and maybe without even thinking about it.
It will, as you say, it becomes a sort of a money pit to maintain your lawn. And also because you're using more and more resources on this lawn, you're taking away from other areas as well. So you'd be using more and more water because soil won't absorb water as efficiently. And you'll be using more on your pesticides and insecticides, which doesn't only have an effect on your lawn, but might have an effect on your neighbour, and might have an effect on, you know, on a larger scale. So if you, you know, you don't want to just take away accountability by saying, oh, it's the, you know, the big farmers in their tractors tilling the fields that's the problem. If you make a big difference on a small scale, then you can, you know, provide homes for an ecosystem of your own in your back garden, which is a beautiful thing. And I'd certainly say it's much more beautiful than an aesthetic and overly perfect lawn.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, this is sort of getting into the solutions, but I don't at all mind this sort of sidetracking here. I'm in agreement. I mean, I believe it's much more beautiful when you have this host of diversity just so close and so present. And I know not everyone sees it like that, but I mean, one of the reasons that we need pesticides, and I'll go on this tangent quickly just so that, you know, anyone who's not listened to the pesticides episodes understands, is that, you know, as we kind of move to these monocultures, which is this sort of having one crop type or one plant type, so maybe just this one type of grass in our lawn, there's no other plant life present, which means that there's no other types of, so certain types of plants actually ward off, naturally kind of repel aphids, and without you know, eradicating them. And so, and this is something, it's beautiful that you can have this diversity in plant life, and by increasing this diversity in plant life, you can accommodate for a diversity in insect life and a diversity in bird life without worrying about the sort of degradation of your back garden. But anyway, to sort of move on from that, these pesticides are not only degrading soil quality and sort of like removing entire pieces from the food web, but also are having a huge impact on bird life. Surprise! Yeah, so when a bird eats a bug with pesticide residue on it, or a plant with pesticide residue on it, of course, because the pesticide is toxic, the pesticide can accumulate in the bird and poison it, which often leads to, you know, the bird's death. While some pesticides have actually been proven to have a detrimental effect not only on the bird's life and the bird's lifespan, but on the thickness of the bird's eggs, making the eggs less likely to survive, and driving down the numbers of birds, including predatory birds such as eagles and hawks, that are sort of hatching per year. And in spite of the fact that some of these said pesticides that were observed to cause a thinning in eggs have been banned in the USA, UK, and EU, there are still at least some loopholes in the US that are legal and used, as mentioned earlier. And there's always some level of unpredictability surrounding these other pesticides, because whether they have a known impact or not, there's a known impact, but whether it's like a known impact that's, you know, detrimental to the, you know, larger scale of the environment or on a smaller scale, I mean, but there's always this unpredictability. So you can't just say, I think a lot of people think as well, there's been this one pesticide type that's banned. I don't recall the name.
DDT.
But this is the one I was talking about before, which causes that egg thinning. Eggshell thinning, and then you people go, oh well, these other pesticides aren't banned, so if I use them, I'm not really having a detrimental effect. But there's simply no like research that's been done to prove that you are having a detrimental effect on the bird life, and it's also as a result of kind of scaling down on our pesticide use. But there's still so much pesticide use that we you know, that there's that there is this observable impact on, of course, insect life, but there's this unpredictable impact on, you know, bird life and mammal life around these areas where pesticides are widely used. I have one more quick point on pesticides. I mean, we've been going for quite a while, but my final point on pesticides is just to point out to the listener base, you know, if you are using pesticides and you sort of you believe that it's this necessity to kind of achieve your idyllic kind of garden or lawn, I mean, there is some level of detriment which pests can do to your garden, and that's undeniable. But I just like to point it out that these pesticide companies do try to make the public more likely to see a benefit in their product by hugely exaggerating the detriment that these pests will do to your lawn. So don't be duped into the whole scheme of pesticides and to the whole idea of pesticides being a necessity. I mean, I think that's something which I just wanted to really quickly point out. Anyway, time for solutions. We'll try and fire through these as quickly as possible. So Taryn, go ahead.
So one solution for the air pollution thing, especially in cities, is to get away from this culture, which is especially in the US, of every person or every family owning a car or two cars, because that's not sustainable, and public transport is proven to be much more efficient and much more practical as well, because it avoids traffic jams and stuff like that. So it would make its cities a lot safer because of less traffic, a lot more efficient, and a lot more sustainable, as well as a lot less polluted.
And I mean, these methods of transport can be metros, trains, trams, buses, shared taxis, perhaps. I mean, there's all these sort of methods that we have, and I think oftentimes it's sort of been stigmatized in the U.S. I'm not as much in Europe and the U.K., which is great, but in the U.S. it's sort of been stigmatized. It's sort of like, if you have money, you have a car, and if you don't, you're using public transport, and this sort of mindset is a big problem, and we'll be looking at in-city transport in a next episode with Oscar, and we've done a whole transport section, everything transport, in season one, so go back and listen to that. That's the first couple of episodes, all hosted by Oscar. Those were great, so go back and listen to those if you haven't already. Our next point, which is very quick, is just try and avoid using charcoal for luxury, just to reduce particulate air pollution, specifically like sulfur dioxide, which can come from charcoal burning. I mean, of course, you know, you having a barbecue, a braai, as some people might call it, or a Barbie, as I don't know if I don't know how that works. Anyway, having, you know, that's a sort of grill, like a one-off grill, it's not horrible. But when you start, everyone has a grill and everyone's grilling and everyone's using charcoal, and it's just sort of for luxury, or maybe you have a charcoal burner in your house, it can be very detrimental, and it can be a cause of acid rain, like we mentioned before. So just try and avoid that as much as possible.
Also, just to add, these barbecues generally tend to release, especially old barbecues, tend to release much more dangerous particulate matter. So they can smaller particles like PM2.5, but also they can induce incomplete combustion, which means that instead of carbon dioxide being released, carbon monoxide will be released, and that is, it's really dead, really, it can be deadly. So that's definitely something that you want to avoid, especially in your back garden.
And so our next solution, which we will be doing an episode on in the foreseeable future, is the regreening of cities. So you know, natural carbon capture, within cities. So this can be, there's this kind of sort of green architecture, which is sort of becoming more common, and I think it's very aesthetic, and I think a lot of people would agree. But this green architecture, so it incorporates greenery, of course, you know, as per the name, in the building. So that might be a house, that might be a proper building, like a work office, and you have like maybe vines on the side, maybe trees in the front, bushes lining, maybe a roof garden or whatever. But green architecture is increasing, and this is, you know, it looks like quite a good way of creating these sort of green ecosystems within our cities and trying to coexist with animals, as well as creating kind of natural carbon capture. And next, of course, petitioning for parks, for new parks, and petitioning to keep parks in place, which you can do via Greenpeace, like we mentioned before, or via other petitioning platforms. And then again, you know, just increasing tree cover along major roadways, and within the, you know, sort of main portion of the city, so along any major roads, around buildings. It's not only is it, you know, good for carbon capture, but it's also very aesthetic and provides a good nesting place and, you know, sort of small ecosystem for surrounding wildlife, so you get more urban wildlife, which is always nice. I believe some people might not like it, but I definitely think it's quite nice to see a bird or two when you're in a city. Taryn, would you like to go ahead and shoot through the next couple?
An obvious one is don't litter. I mean, this may seem very obvious to many people, but you might be littering and not realizing it, even if you're consciously trying not to litter, which I think a lot of people are doing these days. But it's just about not getting into bad habits and making sure that you always take only photographs, leave only footprints. Take only memories, leave only footprints, I think the saying is. And don't leave litter behind, because that's really, it will make the place worse for the next people who go there, whether it's a park or a public transport or whatever it is. And it's a very simple thing of not much cost to the individual, and but infinite benefit if everyone follows that rule.
I'm just gonna let you know I'm on like 5% battery right now, and I can't plug in my iPad because I have my whole setup here. So let's just shoot through the next couple, because also we've gone quite long, which is good, but of course listeners might get, so just shoot through the next two and then I'll continue.
Okay, so another thing, maybe require a little more energy, a little more enthusiasm, but get involved in cleanup projects, litter picking, volunteering around your local community. Educate the local community. Get friends and family involved. It's really great for this sort of stuff. Is really great for not only your environment, but also mental health and community building, because if you're all sort of the community is all trying, all getting together to try and improve the conditions of the immediate environment is great, and I think it's really, really beneficial socially as well as environmentally. And next is try and recycle and upcycle and reuse old things. I know in the UK we don't have the most efficient recycling management system, so I'd understand if a few of the listeners wouldn't particularly trust the recycling bin, which is fair enough. But if you can just try and reuse as much as you can, be creative. There are lots of resources online and stuff, and through charities like Greenpeace as well. You know, there are so many things that you can do with your old egg carton or whatever it is. And it's a really, really mentally beneficial thing, as well as environmentally beneficial thing, because it makes you feel more efficient as well as being it.
And then next, of course, just donating clothes. Again, just another method of recycling to prevent fashion pollution, which is also a thing you might want to look into. And also just hand-me-down toys as well, rather than throwing them away and kind of forcing the younger community to have to buy new toys, which then puts an increased strain on the supply chain and on production, and especially plastic production, because a lot of these toys are made of plastic. Petition and protest against the establishment of new oil rigs, especially those in marine ecosystems and in old growth forests, to prevent the detriment of these sort of very sensitive habitats. Just going to shoot through these very quick now. Be very conscious of your impact on surroundings. A conscious effort to reduce noise pollution and light pollution where possible is very key in reducing light and noise pollution in areas that have a very high risk factor of such pollutants. So you have to know, are there fireflies here? Are there turtles here? Are there, you know, any animals here that are very reliant on sound to communicate? And what's the effect of my noise and of my usage of light?
Also, that will be more energy efficient as well, because if you turn off lights more.
And then, yeah, then that just brings us right to the next one, which is just turn off your lights when possible, to avoid the confusion of neighborhood animals and insect life such as fireflies, which is just the most basic thing you can do, just in terms of like being conscious about your impact. Finally, just government legislation to reduce noise and light pollution. I mean, I suppose you could petition for this, but this really isn't up to the general public. So definitely, I mean, if you see a petition come up, sign it. And if not, this is really down to the government. But government legislation to reduce noise and light pollution is very key in the reduction of noise and light pollution, because it's quite hard for the public to just do that, I suppose. And then finally, just don't use pesticides. I mean, and, you know, if you really want your monocultured lawn, which I don't support, I suppose a route you could take is GMO, which I also don't support. But if you're really desperate, it's definitely better than pesticides. I mean, if you go GMO that's resistant to aphids, then you're not killing butterflies and moths and cicadas and other animals that might feed on the grass. So you're not...
Also, with aphids, I mean, it, although it might be a bit more hands-on, you can just... I mean, it sounds nasty, but you can just squish them, basically. Because if you just squish the aphids, then you're just affecting the aphids. If you spray pesticides on, then you're affecting the whole ecosystem. So it's much better.
Yeah, agreed. And it's really just about, you know, trying to make a conscious effort, and it's what it always comes down to. And that's just kind of what I'd like to leave you guys with today, unless Taryn has anything to add.
I don't think so. I mean, good luck creating your new eco-friendly lawn is all I can say.
Thank you so much for everyone for listening. Please like and subscribe if you haven't already done that, and we'll see you on the next episode. Thank you to Taryn as well. Sorry. Huge thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Bye.